Let's head to Bruce Shapiro, the Executive Director of the Dart Centre for Journalism and Trauma at Columbia University and contributing editor to The Nation. Bruce, good evening. Nice to talk to you again. It's all about border separations in the US at the moment. Talk us through this absolute quagmire.
Well, first, you know, let's start with the fact that this is a remarkable moment in several dimensions. First of all, there's the evidence coming out of exactly what the Trump administration's border separations policy means. You know, this was something Attorney General Sessions announced 6 weeks ago. It's not exactly news, a reversal of the Obama administration's practice of letting migrant families at the border who are crossing illegally stay together. The Obama administration kept folks in family detention centers or gave them or just released them pending a hearing. Sessions said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to separate families. We're going to put parents into detention. We're going to put kids into detention as the law requires, which, of course, is not what the law requires, but they're doing it. Over the last few weeks, there has been growing evidence that now several thousand children are being detained in everything from group homes to cages. The evidence is pretty horrific. Then a few days ago, there were a series of photos from the Pulitzer Prize winner John Moore of Getty Images, who's been chronicling the border for months and months now. He captured an image that immediately became iconic and is one of those moments when photojournalism hits a public nerve, of a small child crying as her mother is being patted down by a Border Patrol agent. Just yesterday, reporter Ginger Thompson of ProPublica obtained audio from one of these detention centers of 10 children, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, screaming and crying for their parents. It's very hard to listen to. But this has had the effect of setting American politics on fire. I mean, even many Republicans in Congress are caught somewhere between what I think is sincere revulsion at these images and sounds and evidence, and fear that this will cost them with moderate voters, panic that this will cost them with moderate voters in a few months' time at the polls. We've had every living first lady, beginning with Laura Bush, denounce the policy as inhumane. And then on the Trump side, on the other hand, you've had presidential advisor Stephen Miller, who crafted this thing. We've had Sessions, Trump himself, all double down and say, blame it on the Democrats, which no one really believes. But it's created a real moment of crisis that is dividing the president from his own party and shifting political sand at the very moment that Congress was getting ready to debate a series of bills on immigration reform. It's a pretty wild moment.
Bruce, I'm interested. You say that, you know, it set in some sort of mild panic and wondering what's going to happen with the voters. But I also wonder equally on the other side about the panic that is going to be inspired by the language that Trump is using, calling people animals and rapists and murderers, describing them as very bad people, even worse, I heard him say at some point earlier today. What do you think his language is doing, and is that going to inspire fear on the other side and in some perverse way end up giving him more support than he might otherwise have?
Well, first of all, this is completely consistent with the language that Donald Trump employed from the beginning of his presidential campaign. He, with the backing of Sessions and the advice of Stephen Miller and others, decided to put immigration at the heart of his political appeal. And it was back in the campaign that he started calling people rapists and calling immigrants, rapists, and murderers, and likening families and children coming over the border to work to violent gangs. So what we're seeing is the embodiment of that policy, of what happens when an administration takes its own caricatured, bigoted rhetoric of a group, of a powerless group of people, to heart and puts it into policy. I mean, that's what we're seeing, dehumanization put into policy. Now, will the president's rhetoric stir more bigotry? Will it stir what he thinks of as his base? Well, I think it will stir the fractional part of his base that's never been the entire Trump electorate. It certainly will stir fervent economic nationalists. It will further stir racists who felt emboldened throughout the campaign and throughout the last 2 years of his presidency, nearly 2 years of his presidency. I mean, you know, this will, there's no doubt that this further inflames those passions, but it is notable that even while radio talk show hosts, some conservative radio talk show hosts have taken the president's side, you really are seeing most elected Republicans, even quite conservative children of Cuban American immigrants, for example, people like Elizabeth Ross Lenihan of Florida or Ted Cruz, distance themselves as far as they can from this. The image of children being put into cages is not something that is going down well. Evangelicals, even Franklin Graham, the son of Billy Graham, and other conservative evangelicals who are a crucial part of the Trump coalition, have pronounced their disgust with this policy and described it as inhumane, all the more so when Attorney General Sessions the other day started claiming that there was biblical support for rigidly following the law that doesn't exist, actually, on this policy. So, you know, anything the president says or does that stirs extreme resentment is going to excite a few people. But this policy at this moment seems to be a political miscalculation by an administration that thus far, you know, has calculated well the limits of Americans' willingness to put up with scapegoating and resentment.
Bruce, do you think Donald Trump believes these things when he says them? Or do you think he's just playing to the crowd, the crowd that he believes he knows what they want to hear?
You know, I'm tempted to say that Donald Trump is a completely empty vessel who believes nothing except what he thinks is expedient. But the reality is that if you look down the long biography of Donald Trump, you do find racism as a core theme of his life. The presenting of minority groups as dangerous criminals has been a consistent theme. This is something going back to the days of the Central Park Five, African-American young men who were wrongly convicted in a famous sexual assault in New York City. Trump led a public campaign against them. His family was, of course, sued for housing discrimination, his father and his own firm, back in the 1970s. So this is, there's something here that is deep in Donald Trump's DNA, a kind of racial and ethnic animus that has proven so politically expedient to him over time that, you know, what he believes, how much he believes, probably doesn't matter, but it is completely intertwined with his public persona at this point.
And he's not alone in stirring up this kind of fear, even hatred to some degree. We're seeing it in different parts of Europe at the moment. In fact, he even pointed to what was going on in Germany and the fact that Angela Merkel might now be struggling for leadership because of letting so many immigrants in. And yet some of the facts, some of the statistics he were giving have been proven to be a little far-fetched.
Well, you know, using phony data is nothing new for Donald Trump. But yes, he's aligned himself with anti-immigrant nationalists the world over. And of course, he is taking delight in seeing Angela Merkel in trouble since she has been his he seems to think of her as the grumpy den mother of Europe, and he resents her very much. So it's no surprise that he's taking some pleasure in her political difficulty. And it's no surprise that the global wave of migration unleashed by the extreme and growing economic inequity is a polarizing feature around the world, from Australia to Europe to the U.S. This is a common problem. Nationalist and bigoted responses to it are a common problem. But nothing in recent American history really compares to the deliberate policy of separating small children from their parents and putting them in what are essentially concentration camps. You have to go back to another shameful moment in our history, to World War II and the internment of Japanese Americans, to come up with a parallel. And even there, children and families were allowed to stay together. There is a degree of cruelty in this moment and in the enactment of this policy, which is unlike anything we have seen at the federal level. And I think we're at a crucial moment where Congress, the courts, the public are going to have to decide whether the country goes further down this road or pulls back from the brink of what are genuinely concentration camp-like conditions for children. This is a dangerous moment for modern American democracy.
Bruce, I've got to let you go, but I do want to ask one question very quickly. What is the long-term forecast for these children?
Well, look, psychologists will tell you that overwhelming stress early in childhood can have a profound effect. Children are resilient. They can handle a lot. But shocking separation from families coming on top of already dangerous journeys in flight from poverty and violence, this isn't good. Politically, the president has basically said, well, it's up to Congress to solve this. On the one hand, he's punting. On the other hand, I do think that Congress has an opportunity to step in and declare this separation policy illegal, and what's more, to make up for it by ensuring that there are supports and services in place for families who are detained at the border. This is going to be personally difficult, awful in the short run for these kids. In the longer run, there's still a chance to make it right for many of them, and I hope the country goes that way.
Bruce, good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Bruce Shapiro, the Executive Director of the Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma at Columbia University.
Mr. Davidson, when you first came across these Brazilian kids, these siblings at the shelter, what state were they in?
Initially, they were extremely confused and they were extremely sad. There had been no one that spoke Portuguese until me. And so there's like a phone translation system, but basically they understood that their mom had disappeared. And in Brazil, that can often mean that they're dead. He immediately started crying, the 16-year-old boy, and I had to initially just reassure him that his mom was, in fact, alive.
And the kids are 16, 10, and 8 years old, and boys and girls?
It was a 16-year-old brother, a 10-year-old sister, and an 8-year-old brother.
The kids had come to Arizona from Texas, well, from Brazil, but through Texas. What's the story? How had they come to end up in Arizona, and where were their parents?
Well, Brazil, they recently had a long strike of the truck drivers. All the Brazilian kids that I encountered had come from a place called Minas Gerais, which is a more rural area of Brazil. They had no food, no gas. All of them basically shared stories of being blackmailed by gangs and threatened by gangs. And they told me that there will be more Brazilian immigrants coming.
And so that's why the family made the move. When was the last time that they saw their mother?
I'd know that until this time they haven't seen their mother. So that's now May 29th. So
what instructions did you get as to what to tell them?
Differing. No one knew. When they had me translate, they said, well, it could be a week, at least a week until they find their mom, and then another week to be able to talk to her, and they're not sure where she is, and ICE was slow in giving out the information, and it seemed that all the departments were confused, and no one really knew what to say in terms of where she was. Was she in a migrant center? Was she in prison?
So what did you tell them?
Well, I told them what most people had told me, which is that she was in a detention an immigrant detention center, similar to where they were at, but for adults. Then, as I learned that that may not actually be the case, she might actually be in jail. That's when I started to, in addition to the episode in which I had to separate them and was told that they couldn't hug, that was when I started to realize, like, this is not the direction that I think this process should be going.
Whoa, they were separated?
The siblings, yes. On their first night there, I was asked at one point to make space for them to sleep on the floor in a classroom. This was the day after they had been separated from their mom. And then so it wasn't until 8 a.m. that they were being given a bed. The staff, they decided to separate the brother and all of them into three separate rooms. So they grasped each other and they were just wailing and like just really crying. And the younger siblings were like, please, I don't want to be separated from you. And so they called me on the radio. They called me and they said, Ansar, we need you to come in and help translate. Tell them that they're not allowed to hug. I tell them I'm not going to say that, but I'm on my way to help. So I get there, the kids are by themselves, and I see the older brother hugging his siblings, and they're holding on to him for dear life and with tears streaming down their face. And I tell him, bro, you have to be strong. He looks over to me with tears streaming down his face and says, how? Look at my siblings. Where's my mom? How can I be strong in a time like this? The shift leader came over very aggressively and told me, tell them that they can't hug. Diles que no pueden abrazar. And I, at that point, told her, no. As a human being, I can't do that. That was a very visceral and very painful situation for me. And at that point, I realized that if I was to stay in this organization, I would be having to basically take orders to do things that were against my morals and ultimately against what the organization claims to be.
I don't know what to say. This is an extraordinary story. And did they ever tell you why the kids weren't allowed to hug?
Well, there's a general policy. Minors are not allowed to touch each other. In the context of the business model of this organization, it makes plenty sense. The organization is run on a private prison model, which is do the minimum for compliance while the shareholders take the most of the federal grants. It's funded 98% by the Office of Refugee Resettlement. The people that are successful in this organization are the ones that are basically able to just shuffle them through, right? These kids are just dollar amounts. These people that work there and work with these kids are underpaid, undertrained, and underprepared. And for that reason, they're very incompassionate. It's just like, you do what I tell you, and that's it. And I just want to take my money and leave.
The 2007, when it began, it was a different kind of institution, wasn't it? I mean, it began, it was for unaccompanied minors, kids who were crossing on their own. How is it different now?
The kids that were initially coming, they knew the drill. They paid a guide. They got to the border. They went to Border Patrol. They had their papers. They had their sponsor. They were told beforehand they'd be in a shelter for a month. So they knew that. And for that reason, they were compliant. And therefore, they were easy to manage. Now, as the zero tolerance policy was rolled out, that model came under pressure. That model came under threat because the new population they were receiving, it was now kids that were much younger who had been ripped from their parents. And there was nothing that people were telling them concretely that would have to do with knowing where their parents were. So you had a clear shift in the population that was being placed into these facilities.
The company, Southwest Key, says that, in answer to your story, that it operates shelters and that there's nobody sleeping on the floors of classrooms and all the staff is properly trained. The ratios of staff to kids is exactly what it's supposed to be by law. What do you say to that?
If I'm wrong and lying, they're welcome to show the cameras and prove that that didn't happen precisely at the time that it happened. Also, if you would look at a person looks at any job board in which there's a Southwest Key facility, you will find an endless, almost ubiquitous stream of job requests. I was asked personally if I would be willing to work for 6 days a week indefinitely. Every shift, 10 people would be asked to stay overtime. And if a person doesn't believe me, I welcome you to Google Southwest Key programs, go on to any job site and read the reviews of people that have worked there.
You left this job when your own humanity couldn't continue doing that kind of work and telling kids these things. So you don't know what's happened to these three Brazilian kids. Can you imagine where they are? Do you have any idea what happened to them?
The three immediately the next day became seven. And to the best of my knowledge, they're probably still there. When I left, they were there and they did not have any concrete answers.
And did not know where their mothers were.
For the most part, no.
Mr. Davidson, I appreciate you telling us the story. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity and have a wonderful day, Carol.
It's exactly 1:30 the hour. You're listening to Paris Live PM here on Radio France International. Straight back over now to Angela Diffley for another look at today's main news stories. Angela.
France and Germany are seeking deals with frontline states in Europe's migration crisis to return asylum seekers to the EU country where they were first registered, usually their point of arrival. That's what President Emmanuel Macron said today after meeting the German Chancellor Angela Merkel in Meseberg in Germany. France and Germany have also agreed to set up a common budget for the Eurozone. But it's unclear at the moment how much money that will involve. The size will be discussed with other members of the EU bloc. In the United States, the Secretary for the Department of Homeland Security has been defending the Trump administration's new immigration policy at the U.S.-Mexico border. There's been an outcry over the separation of children from their parents as a result of the administration's so-called zero-tolerance immigration policy. The administration says it warns parents they're likely to be separated from their children if they try to cross the border illegally.
You're listening to The Newsroom from the BBC World Service with me, Nick Miles. President Trump has consistently said he wants a solution to the current impasse over immigration into the US. There's been growing criticism of his policy of separating migrant children from their parents when they cross illegally into America from Mexico. Now, Mr. Trump is lobbying Republican politicians on new immigration legislation, which would include billions of dollars to build a wall with Mexico. Speaking at a business event in Washington, he said the law needed changing.
What I'm asking Congress to do, which we have been requesting since last year, the legal authority to detain and promptly remove families together as a unit. We have to be able to do this. This is the only solution to the border crisis. We have to stop child smuggling. This is the way to do it. And ultimately, we have to have a real border.
Gary O'Donoghue is our correspondent in the US. He's at a migrant detention center in Brownsville, Texas. Gary, let's get to those political maneuverings in Washington in a moment. But first, what have you been hearing today about the scale of the child migrant problem there?
Well, we're getting some new figures today on the numbers of children who have been separated from their parents. These are official figures from the Department of Homeland Security and the Department for Health and Human Services. And they're looking at over a five-week period from the beginning of May to into June, that 2,342 children were separated from their parents after coming across the border. Now, we do know that from previous figures that the departments have admitted to in court, that means that somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 children have been separated since October of last year. And what we don't know, and what we have no idea of, is how many of them have been reunited with their parents since.
So meanwhile, protests continue, criticism continues. What about the legislation that Donald Trump wants to get through? What signs are there that he will get through the type of legislation he wants in Congress?
Well, I don't think the signs are very good for what he wants. He wants something much more broad, much more sort of ambitious in scope, if you like, that would include all sorts of things like funding for his border wall, that would include longer-term solutions for the undocumented young people, the DACA, so-called DACA people. But what the Senate leadership, Republican leadership in the Senate, seems to be thinking is that something much more narrow is the most likely thing to get passed, something that alleviates the immediate PR problem of children being separated from families, because I think they're starting to feel that this is doing damage. And of course, we're in an election year, and that political damage could be significant when the House and the Senate are up for grabs.
Indeed. Gary O'Donoghue, many thanks. Well, adding to the criticism of the policy of separating the children from their parents, earlier on Monday, the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights called the current situation unconscionable. He was speaking at the latest session of the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva. Now, for some time, there's been little love lost between the Council and Washington, so it perhaps should come as no surprise that America has just withdrawn its membership. The US ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, has been talking about that decision.
The United States is officially withdrawing from the UN Human Rights Council. In doing so, I want to make it crystal clear that this step is not a retreat from human rights commitments. On the contrary, we take this step because our commitment does not allow us to remain a part of a hypocritical and self-serving organization that makes a mockery of human rights.
Well, we're joined on the line in New York by our correspondent, Neda Torfik. Neda, what evidence did she cite to back up those words?
Well, she has two chief complaints. She said that human rights abusers continue to serve on the council. They remain able to be elected without really any scrutiny or competitive elections taking place. And then she said kind of the chief complaint is this chronic anti-Israeli bias. And she said that that's because of this agenda item 7, this permanent item on the council's work. That means that every time the council meets, it has to review Israel's conduct. And she says that singles out Israel because no other country goes through that level of scrutiny, even those who are accused of horrible human rights abuses like North Korea and Syria. And so she said that the UN body became a cesspool of political bias and that they could no longer support being on the council.
Yeah, strong words. And now Washington is out. But what impact is it going to have on the work and, more importantly, perhaps the credibility of the council?
Well, Ambassador Haley cited that, saying many diplomats had told her that they didn't want to see the council undermined by the United States pulling out, but she disregarded that. We've had so many statements coming out, whether it be Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, others, saying that this really is a step back for global human rights, that the United States does have to lead by example and uphold how important it is to protect and promote human rights around the world, saying that other countries are just going to now have to redouble their efforts. But people at the United Nations were not surprised by this. The Secretary General had been warned yesterday afternoon that this was coming. He believes, of course, that the UN Human Rights Council does do very important work. It's a key part of the UN's efforts to advance human rights. And so he clearly said he wished the United States had stayed.
Okay, Neda, thanks very much. Migration, its causes and effects, and crucially, how governments respond to it, has been hotly debated on both sides of the Atlantic again today. Mexico's foreign minister, Luis Videgaray, has weighed into the row over how children crossing from his country into the US are being separated from their parents. I want to express our most categorical and energetic condemnation of this cruel and inhuman policy, he said. But the US President, Donald Trump, is refusing to change his approach and blaming Mexico instead.
They come up through Mexico. Mexico does nothing for us. You hear it here. They do nothing for us. They could stop it. They have very, very strong laws. Try staying in Mexico for a couple of days. See how long that lasts. Okay?
Meanwhile, here in Europe, the issue of who belongs and who doesn't is centre stage. Comments by Italy's Interior Minister, Matteo Salvini, about the Roma community have been condemned as unacceptable by the UN. Mr. Salvini has said Roma should be registered and those deemed to be there illegally deported. The head of the UN Human Rights Office in Europe, Brigitte Bahnhof, said this stigmatised the Roma.
Statements like this, they just further stigmatise the Roma. And coming from a deputy prime minister of a founding member of the European Union is very unacceptable. Politicians should lead by example. They should refrain from inciting to racial and ethnic hatred.
Eric Lyman is a freelance journalist in Rome. I've been speaking to him and I asked him how Mr. Salvini had reacted to the criticism.
He seems to be digging in his heels. At first, it seemed like he was backing away from it. But then he said today in a tweet that that he was sticking with the plans that was going forward and that he wanted to keep track of how many Roma, how many gypsies there were in Italy. And so there seems to be no stopping them.
And how will this go down with ordinary Italians? There is a lot of antipathy from many Italians to the Roma in Italy.
This makes it very tricky because when it comes to refugees or education or things like that, there's widespread support. And so some of these things that Salvini is against, most people are in favor of, or at least a lot of people are in favor of. But polls show regularly that there's 75 or 80 or 85% of Italians who have a negative view on the Roma population. And so I have a feeling that there's going to be a lot less rank and file opposition to this than there would be in some other areas.
So if indeed he feels compelled to go about this, do you think it's something he's really going to put into practice?
It's hard to believe that he'll be able to follow through along the terms that he said. In 2008, Silvio Berlusconi, who was prime minister at the time, tried to institute something similar and it was struck down by circuit court. I believe that the Italian constitution does not allow for specific segments of the population to be counted in this way. I think it's going to end up being more of a public relations measure than anything.
So do you think this is more of a sideshow to the wider issue of the migrant problem as it's seen by some in Italy?
There's a lot of support for this kind of thing, and Salvini's party, the League, is surging. It's now the biggest party in Italy, according to approval levels and so on. And so I think all this plays into that. But I think that this is a particular problem. It's low cost, according to a source that I spoke to today, in terms of money. It's a stance that the government can take. It's got relatively wide support. It doesn't cost a lot of money. And I think that they get most of the benefits of that without actually having to follow through on it.
Meanwhile, the drive for Mr. Salvini to deport up to 500,000 migrants, that will continue.
All indications are that that is correct, that he will go forward with that plan. He told them last week that they should start getting ready and to pack their bags. And if they're not in Italy legally, there seems to be nothing that would stop him from doing that. As we know, he's turned away some rescue vessels with refugees on board. And so that part of the plan looks like it's moving forward.
That was Eric Lyman in Rome. Well, trying to find a unified EU response to immigration was, as expected, one of the main topics at the meeting of the German Chancellor Angela Merkel and her French counterpart, President Emmanuel Macron. After the meeting in the town of Merseburg, Mrs. Merkel said that the problem of migration was threatening to divide Europe.
We want coordinated action, preferably a European approach. That's proving very difficult, which is why it's possible to look at cooperation between single countries. But our aim continues to be a European answer to these challenges. We want to avoid a further division of Europe, and we want to find common solutions. Those fleeing war and persecution must be able to ask for asylum, but not to choose in which country to apply for asylum.
But is it possible to agree on a common position at the next European summit less than 2 weeks to go? I asked our correspondent Jenny Hill in Berlin what progress had been made by Chancellor Merkel and President Macron.
You know, I'm not sure that really what we heard today isn't what we've heard before. President Macron and Angela Merkel once again emphasised their thought about there being a need for a unified response in the EU to the migration challenge. And, you know, good luck with that in some respects. We know just how divided different EU member states are over how to tackle that challenge. A couple of points. President Macron talked about raising the number of Frontex officers to protect the external borders. Talks again, we've heard it all before, about trying to tackle the causes of migration, more investment in Africa and so on, trying to tackle people traffickers. I suppose what was different today is that we heard some pretty strong language from the French president, who talked about this particular time in Europe, this particular decision for Europe, being not just about a decision for the European society, but about human civilization, full stop. And that gives you a sense, I think, of where the two leaders see this challenge in a global perspective now, of course. A couple of points about Chancellor Merkel, who's been under a lot of pressure on migration policy domestically. She did get an assurance, the first bilateral one, actually, of its kind from President Macron, about returning migrants who've already registered in a different EU country first to that country. President Macron said he fully supports that and that he is willing to do that where France is concerned. So it's a small victory for Angela Merkel today.
Yeah, you were saying that it's important for Mr. Macron to be there to bolster her in a difficult week for her. But it's only a short-term reprieve, I suppose. She has to go to the summit next week, the EU summit, and come back with something that's going to satisfy her coalition partners.
Yes, although I think actually even the CSU, the Bavarian sister party to her Conservatives, who are pushing her so hard, I think even they accept that she's not going to come back with a single European overarching strategy. You know, that's not something that can be achieved so quickly. In a way, Mrs. Merkel's in a bit of a corner, regardless of what happens. If she comes back from the summit with victory, with something to show for it, then the CSU will immediately say, well, you only did it because we pushed you into it. If they say what she comes back with isn't satisfactory, and Horst Seehofer, the interior minister and leader of the CSU, goes ahead with his plan and starts sending migrants back without any of those agreements in place, she'll have really no choice but to sack him for such open rebellion. That, of course, means that her alliance, her Conservatives' alliance with his party, falls apart potentially. And we all know what that could mean for the very fragile coalition government with the Social Democrats here.
That was Jenny Hill. It looks like there's been a significant development in the civil war in Yemen. Pro-government forces backed by the United Arab Emirates are reported to have stormed the airport serving the rebel-held city of Hodeidah. Our World Affairs correspondent Paul Adams is following developments.
The focus of the fighting for the last few days has been for the airport, which is just to the southeast of the city itself. For the last couple of days, there have been reports that the pro-government militias who are leading this fight had captured the whole area. I think only today did we learn that the pro-government forces do indeed appear to be in control, if not of the whole airport complex, then certainly the heart of it. So the first strategic objective of this campaign, at least the fight for Hodeidah, does appear to have been secured. The question now is, where do these forces, backed by the Saudi-led coalition, go? The indications are that they want to secure the road between Hodeidah and the capital Sana'a. That would cut off the Houthis' lifeline from Hodeidah into the rest of Yemen. And then, of course, there'll be the question of the port itself, which is still open, remarkably. The UN says that three ships were unloading there today, but ultimately will be also one of the objectives of this campaign.
And remind us, if you would, how important that port being open is.
It is absolutely critical. The overwhelming bulk of the aid that gets into Yemen that is badly needed comes through that port. Now, what the Saudi-led coalition has been saying is that as long as the Houthis, the rebel Houthis, have remained in control of Hodeidah, they've had a stranglehold over the aid coming into the country. They make a lot of money out of licenses for ships docking at the port, and also have used Hodeidah as a smuggling route for weapons from outside, something that's not been particularly verified by other sources, but that's an allegation that has been made. So it is an absolutely critical aid lifeline. It has strategic military value. And so for the last couple of years, the Saudi-led coalition has had it in its sights, but only in the last week or so has it made this concerted effort to do it.
That was Paul Adams. You're listening to the BBC World Service. Still to come on the newsroom, the painting that's been taken down as an English city reassesses its past.
How it was displayed is almost a reverence and a kind of celebration of these controversial characters who have actually been held up as heroes.
First, David has the headlines.
The Mexican foreign minister has denounced President Trump's policy of separating migrant families at the US border as cruel and inhumane. The United Nations has condemned plans by Italy's new interior minister to count members of the Roma community and deport some of them. And Malaysia's new prime minister says his predecessor, Najib Razak, could soon face charges of embezzlement and bribery.
Thanks. The Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has been carrying out some ambitious plans to transform society. Men and women have been allowed to attend the same pop concerts, cinemas have opened, and in a few days' time, the ban on women driving will come to an end. But is there a backlash? The head of the Entertainment Authority in Saudi Arabia has been sacked. Our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher, is with me. So what's happening here? Why has he been removed?
Well, there hasn't been a reason given officially. A royal decree was issued late on Monday evening by the King Salman, though essentially the real driving force behind all of this is the Crown Prince, his son, Mohammed bin Salman. But there's been a lot of speculation in the Saudi media and elsewhere that it's to do with some of the events that the Entertainment Authority has introduced to Saudi Arabia, unprecedented pop concerts, opera, all sorts of things in the past 2 years since it was started. And the latest thing was a Russian circus, which was in the capital Riyadh, and images of one of the performers, a female trapeze artist in a leotard, covering her body completely, but tight-fitting, as you'd expect, started to go viral. And there was a hashtag posted on Twitter talking about Russian naked women in Riyadh. And this was seized on by, I have to say that the voices that I've seen have been of young people rather than older people, saying that this is against Saudi tradition. We shouldn't be allowing this. This comes not so long after a huge wrestling event was held in Riyadh too. Female wrestlers weren't invited to it, but at one point on the big screen, some of them were shown, and again, in quite skimpy clothes. That also caused a problem. The Sports Authority apologised there, but no one was sacked.
So it's just perhaps a case that it was too much too quickly. What about the reforms as a whole, though?
Well, the reforms as a whole, as you say, on Sunday, Saudi women will be allowed to drive for the first time. This is a very, very long fought for right. Women sacrificed their jobs. They went to prison, all sorts of things for that. But the problem with that is that although this right is being given, the women who were the leading voices behind that are actually all detained at the moment. So very much it goes backwards and forwards. Now, one thing that the people supporting what Mohammed bin Salman have been saying today is that it shows what they've been saying for some time, that there are concerns, there are dangers in what he's doing. It shouldn't just be seen that he has all the authority and he can push it as he likes and he's overcoming dissent, but that there are people who are waiting for him who are against these reforms and will strike if they get the chance.
Okay, Sebastian, we'll leave it there. Many thanks. That was Sebastian Usher. David's here with some other stories from our news desk.
The UK government is to review the use of cannabis for medicinal purposes following appeals from the mothers of two sick children. The son of one of the women involved was today granted a licence allowing his severe epilepsy to be treated with cannabis oil. After the review was announced, Charlotte Caldwell, who began campaigning when her son Billy was denied access to the therapy, welcomed the decision.
At every single stage of this campaign, we have mentioned making history. And we have mentioned it because common sense and the power of mothers and fathers of sick children has bust the political process wide open.
The authorities in Nigeria say they'll close their border with an unnamed neighbouring country within the next few days to stop foreign rice being smuggled in. The country's agriculture minister said the rice, which originally comes from China and Southeast Asia, contained poisonous materials and arsenic. Nigeria is among a number of African countries seeking to increase their local rice production. The authorities in California have found more than 500 guns inside the home of a convicted criminal. The Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department said they searched the property after receiving a tip-off from a neighbor. A man has been charged and released on bail. And the organisation that looks after historic monuments in England has warned that amateur treasure hunters are digging holes around the ancient Roman structure of Hadrian's Wall and stealing precious artefacts. Fiona Trott has more.
Historic England says more than 50 holes have been found around the Brunton Turret section of the World Heritage Site, which was built by the 20th Legion of the Roman Army around 1,900 years ago. The agency is blaming nighthawks, people who go out at night and use metal detectors without permission to steal ancient artefacts. It says the illegal practice is robbing the country of its Roman heritage because items are being removed without care or any record of their context.
That was Fiona Trott. The Russian football team is 20 minutes into its second match at the Football World Cup. This time it's against Egypt and it's nil all at the moment. There's been particular focus on Egypt's superstar Mo Salah, who's playing for the first time since injuring his shoulder in the Champions League final. Off the pitch, he and his team are based in the southern Russian Republic of Chechnya. The region's leader, Ramzan Kadyrov, is accused of serious human rights violations and now of using Salah and his teammates for some political point scoring. Steve Rosenberg sent this report from Chechnya.
Well, this is the Egyptian national team in training in Grozny, in Chechnya. And among the players, one of the stars of world football right now, Mo Salah. You know, part of me still cannot believe that there is a World Cup training ground in Grozny. And that is because I will never forget what this city looked like not that long ago, after two wars. From war zone to World Cup, that is quite a journey. But Chechnya's connection to this tournament is controversial. Tanya Lokshina is Russia Programme Director for Human Rights Watch.
Chechnya is the most repressive region of Russia. Chechnya is a place where Russian laws, not to mention Russia's international human rights obligations, simply do not apply in practice. The only laws that exist in Chechnya today are the orders given by Ramzan Kadyrov, the local strongman who's been running Chechnya through brutal repression for over a decade with the Kremlin's blessing.
Within hours of the Egyptian team arriving in Grozny, Ramzan Kadyrov had engineered a surprise photo opportunity with its top player. In front of cheering fans, he paraded Mo Salah round the Akhmat Stadium. Later, Mr. Kadyrov invited us to his palace. "You can ask me anything," he said. So I asked him first about that photo op. Your critics say that you used Mo Salah for political propaganda, for self-promotion. Did you?
Everyone has played here, even Maradona. But we never use this kind of thing for politics. Our enemies are paid to write things like that. I didn't invite Mo Salah or the Egyptian team. They chose us themselves.
Driving around Grozny, you can see that under Ramzan Kadyrov, Chechnya has been rebuilt from scratch. But at what cost? Human rights groups say that Mr. Kadyrov has created a climate of fear through arbitrary arrests and torture. And they accuse him of persecuting Chechnya's gay community. I put the allegations to him. Extrajudicial executions, forced disappearance of opponents, persecution of homosexuals. These are the allegations made against you in Chechnya. Is this true?
The people who write these things, I don't consider them people. We don't have homo, what did you call it? Homosexuality. We don't even know that word. We don't talk about gays. We don't have a single one. Here, the man is a man, a woman is a woman, a dog is a dog.
At Grozny's central mosque, it's evening prayers. In Chechnya, people cherish their traditions, their customs, their faith. But Ramzan Kadyrov's image as the strong man of Chechnya jars with what FIFA claims the World Cup is all about: diversity, fairness, and bringing people together.
Steve Rosenberg reporting.
The Lord Mayor of Bristol in the west of England has taken down a 300-year-old portrait in her office of the slave trader Edward Colston. Cleo Lake said she could no longer share her workplace with the image of a man whose role in history is now being criticised. This report from the newsroom's Richard Hamilton.
The portrait of Edward Colston dates back to 1702 and has been hanging in the City Hall since 1953. The name Colston is synonymous with both the city of Bristol and the slave trade. He was a merchant and Member of Parliament in the mid to late 17th century and played a key role in the Royal African Company, which gained complete control of Britain's slave trade. Historians say thousands of people died on board his slave ships. Now the Lord Mayor, Cleo Lake, has ordered the portrait to be taken down.
I don't find it tokenistic. I am of African Jamaican heritage, so my ancestors were the victims of enslavement. I'm aware of the trauma that exists within pockets of my community today. So the legacy of that period is very much alive. Whilst I was not comfortable having the portrait in my parlour, where I spend nearly every day in office, nor did I think it was suitable to have that in City Hall full stop, because how it was displayed is almost a reverence and a kind of celebration of these controversial characters who have actually been held up as heroes.
As a philanthropist, Colston gave away some of his fortune to good causes in Bristol, setting up a school and building almshouses. The city has at least 20 roads, schools, businesses and buildings named after Colston. But activists have been pressuring the authorities to dissociate themselves from him. Bristol's largest concert venue, Colston Hall, has already dropped the name, and there are discussions about removing a stained glass window from Bristol Cathedral, which also bears his name. But others complain that this is an attempt to eradicate or suppress history. Similar arguments have surrounded statues of the colonialist Cecil Rhodes in South Africa and at Oxford University. Cleo Lake has now replaced the portrait of Colston with a picture of a lion.
And before we go, our main headline again. The Mexican foreign minister has denounced President Trump's policy of separating migrant families at the US border as cruel and inhumane.